She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Hello and welcome to The Persistence. This is She Who Persisted, the Nasty Podcast. My name is Beatrice and I'm here with...
Elizabeth.
And Heather cannot be with us today, but she sent us a recording that we're going to play. So she will also take part in the episode, but she's not actually live with us right now. Last time we talked about Wonder Woman and female superheroes. This time it's going to be a lot more depressing. So it's one of those grab your chocolate episodes, right?
Absolutely.
It was even depressing preparing for it. So yeah, do you want to say the topic? Because it's, yeah.
Well, yeah, the topic for today is women as patients.
Yay.
So yeah, exactly. Yeah. So women, how they're treated when they go to see the doctor, historical perspectives of women being pathologized, and just generally crap that you have to deal with when you go to the doctor.
Yeah, yeah. So being ill and dying is generally not a nice part of life. But then when you're a woman,
not really.
When you're a woman, things are much more fucked up even. So
yeah,
so definitely. So what we're trying to tell you is get a lot of chocolate right now. Get chocolate. We'll wait for you.
Absolutely.
Okay, you're back. Great. Okay, so I'm gonna start with a quote from the Bible.
Oh Jesus!
As we do at this podcast, to the woman God said, "I will greatly multiply your pain in childbearing." "In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you."
Ugh.
Genesis 3:16.
Fuck.
Elizabeth already regrets not having chocolate by her side.
I absolutely do. I absolutely do.
Yeah, I know.
This part of the Old Testament always makes me kind of angry.
Oh, does it? Why?
Yeah, it's so much. Because it's always used to justify why women are evil. Women are, they're the reason that we experience pain and we have shitty lives. And if Eve had just like not eaten from the tree and fallen for Satan's trick, everything would be lovely and wonderful.
Yeah.
Fuck
exactly.
That.
It's all our fault.
Yeah.
And the Old Testament, right, brings us to the topic of pain.
Yes.
And female pain, and women experiencing pain, and women and how they're treated for the pain they experience. So, first of all, we have this interesting quote unquote, as in misogynistic, phenomenon of women not being taken seriously for the pain by doctors. In the US, nationwide, men wait an average of 49 minutes before receiving treatment for acute abdominal pain, and women wait an average of 65 minutes for the same thing. So there's already a gap.
Look, because acute abdominal pain could just be your cramps. So hold your horses, ladies. You
exactly.
don't need help.
Exactly. Yeah, just take ibuprofen. It's going to be fine.
I have a great story about abdominal pain, actually. My mother-in-law, when she was younger, it was kind of the 60s, she had long hair. People thought she was maybe like just looking for drugs at the hospital. But in fact, her appendix had burst. And they finally did a blood test and tested to make sure like that she was actually sick. And they found out, oh, while you were sitting here 45 minutes ago, your appendix burst and you could have died. So let's get you in to take your appendix out.
Oh, nice. Oh, nice. Another problem is not just the time that women have to wait until they get treatment. It's also the type of treatment that they get. Because while men tend to get actual treatment for their pain, women very often get sedatives.
Well, I mean, how bad are sedatives,
It
really?
Might just be psychological, right? It's just a psychosomatic thing. That's something that very often happens, is that physical pain gets pathologized as like a psychological problem with women.
Oh, sure. Don't be hysterical, lady. You're just being crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, hysteria. Yeah, we're going to talk about that later, right? Yeah, but there's actually a very interesting article in The Atlantic from the year 2015, and it is a personal story of a man whose wife's illness was not taken seriously by doctors in the emergency room, and what she had was a very serious gynecological emergency. I think it was an ovarian cyst, right?
I think that's right.
Yeah, and her pain was interpreted as kidney stones.
I mean, kidney stones hurt really bad too, but...
Yeah. So at the beginning, she didn't really receive treatment at all. And then a male doctor basically said it's just kidney stones. And the husband of the woman who experienced this wrote an article about it. And he wrote, quote, "I felt certain of this. The diagnosis of kidney stones, repeated by the nurses and confirmed by the attending physician's prescribed course of treatment, was a denial of the specifically female nature of Rachel's pain. A more careful examiner would have seen the need for gynecological evaluation. Later, doctors told us that Rachel's swollen ovary was likely palpable through the surface of her skin. But this particular emergency room, like many in the United States, had no attending OBGYN, and every nurse's shrug seemed to say, 'Women cry. What can you do?'"
Oh, screw them. You know, I get it. Like, I get that they're overworked in emergency rooms, but honestly, all doctors are trained to do pelvic exams. It's not like you have to have an OBGYN. They should all be trained how to do this. And women have different parts than men. So let's actually take a look at those parts to make sure that they're all in order and where they should be.
Yeah. I mean, I think just in that quote from the article, we already see like various problems coming up. So the first problem is that there's no OBGYN even present. So that already... you know, says a lot about how seriously, specifically female, how serious issues are taken that affect female-bodied people.
Yes.
Which, not really seriously at all, because if, yeah, so there's no like, specialist there. Then also the issue of women cry, what can you do? So it's just a psychological thing. She's just weak and, like, hysterical, and it's not to be taken seriously. And then the third thing is that a female doctor then diagnosed that it was an ovarian problem, a gynecological problem. And the male doctor didn't even come up with the idea that it could be something else. He just assumed it was kidney stones. So it's also like this issue of the male dominance of the medical world, that there are too few female doctors treating female patients. Because it kind of, you know, being born in a female body might also result in a different kind of sensitivity towards what women go through and what bodies they have and what issues could come up.
I think it's absurd that it took 14 and a half hours for her to get surgery for an ovarian cyst that was causing her pain. And you're right, only after a female doctor took the tests did it essentially save her life.
Before we get any further, I'd like to include Heather's story about her experiences as a pregnant woman not being listened to by her doctors, both in terms of pain and, you know, in terms of a serious medical issue that almost cost her her life.
So although I don't have a lot of personal experience as a woman with doctors not really taking me seriously, thankfully, I'm sure that a lot of that has to do with I haven't had to be in any serious situations. But the only thing that really comes to mind for me was, well, I guess a couple things, but the one that I'm going to highlight right now is that whenever I was pregnant with my second child, I started to have very severe pain. And I know that I mentioned this back in one of our first episodes when we were talking about pregnant bodies, I believe. But I was having extreme pain in my pelvis. And what would happen was, because one of the wonders of pregnancy is that your ligaments start to loosen up and hormones cause things to shift and pop. And anyway, your pelvis and your pubic bones can actually, they can start to separate to get ready for birth, but they can also then, because they're so loose and getting ready to separate, it can cause the pubic bones to grind together. So my pelvis would become misaligned, and then even if I would be sitting for, I don't know, a minute or something, it didn't even really take that long, it would become misaligned, and when I would go to stand back up, my pubic bones would just grind together and pop, and this was much, much worse if I was laying down at night going to sleep. So I would go to the doctor every time that I would go in for, you know, an OB checkup. And I would bring this up, that it was extremely painful and it hurt so badly. And the pop would be so loud that you could hear it across the room. And I was basically told that that was just one of the joys of pregnancy. I obviously say that sarcastically, but that's pretty much what I was told, that it was typical of pregnancy and there was really nothing I could do about it. If I wanted to alleviate the pain, then I should make sure that I sleep with a pillow between my legs. Except this problem wasn't only at night when I was sleeping. Obviously, it was when I was sitting down as well. And also, just a side note, the pillow between the legs really didn't stop it. It helped a little bit, but it didn't stop it. And so I dealt with it for my second pregnancy and just really wished that it would go away after birth, because that's what they told me. You'll be fine when the baby gets here. Everything will go back the way it should. And luckily for me, it did. But when I got pregnant with my third child, I remembered how painful it was, and I started to look into it a little bit more, and I found out that it's an actual problem that a lot of women have, and it's called symphysis pubis dysfunction. And when I started to read online some women giving their testimonials about it, there were women describing this the same pain that I had, being told the same things that I was told, and then finding out that once they had their baby, things didn't get better. And some women had it so badly that they couldn't walk at the end of their pregnancy. And then some of them that after they had their baby, they still had the problem. Some women were paralyzed. And so when I got pregnant with my third child, I told my husband, if this happens again, I have to get help. I don't know exactly what I should do, but I had read online that some women found relief through going to the chiropractor and having the chiropractor realign your pelvis. So I went ahead and decided the day that I felt that pain, because again, with like successive pregnancies, certain things happen faster, or I guess I shouldn't say faster, but sooner in your pregnancy than previously. Like you're going to show a lot sooner for subsequent pregnancies than you would for your first. The same thing happens with the loosening of the ligaments. So I'm not even sure I was out of the first trimester. Maybe I was with my third that I started to have that pain. And the day I had the pain, I called a chiropractor here near where I live and asked if they had experience with that and if they could help me. And they said, absolutely. And they had me in that afternoon. And every week, I believe it might've been two, mommy brain here. I can't remember, but it was at least every week or every other week I would go in, and the best relief was literally her like pulling on my legs and then realigning the lower half of my body. Of course she would do the typical chiropractor things of trying to align the rest of my spine and stuff, because she said that it helped, but I didn't have any problems there. And then I also wouldn't let her crack my neck, but that's a whole different discussion. But yeah, that's how I survived. And I didn't have any pain after that first initial one, the day that I called her, I didn't have any pain. But it was just so frustrating because it's a known thing. If you go online, you find women in like the mommy forums that are looking for support or whatever. There's articles written on it. It's a thing. And to talk to my OB, who is going to help deliver my baby, tell me that there's nothing I can do, it's kind of unnerving. And then I think the only other thing that I could really speak to, which I am certain is partly because of being a woman, but also because of the inexperience of the person who was doing this, was, and I think that I talked about this on a previous episode as well, but whenever I was giving birth to my first child and we went in and we were induced, it was a learning hospital, which means that there are student doctors that come in. They haven't completed their residency yet, but they're in the middle of the residency, and they come in and they check to see how far dilated you are and then go from there. And when, you know, the show really gets on the road, then the actual doctors come in. But anyway, there was a young man that came in to check me, and he seemed so nervous. He was asking me questions, and I was actually correcting him on the questions because he was, I don't know, he didn't even know what he was asking me. And I felt really unnerved. But again, being my first pregnancy, I think a lot of times, and I'm sure I'm not the only one here, you tend to want to hope that the doctors know more than you. And I tried to trust him, and I actually went against my instincts. My husband felt like we should not trust him either, but I said, no, everybody has to learn. I'm sure he's just nervous because he's new. and let's just trust him on this. And he came in and checked me and said that I was far enough along to start on Pitocin because I was supposedly a week overdue. And then a few hours later came in and said, oh yes, you're up to so many, you know, 3 or 5 centimeters now. You can start your epidural. And so they gave me an epidural. And then he came in and said, oh, I don't know. I think he might have even said 8 centimeters. And we aren't getting as much progress as we would like. We're going to have to break your water. And then they brought the head resident doctor in. Now, every time that he would check me, it hurt so much, worse than any other doctor or nurse that had checked me throughout the rest of my pregnancy. And I told him that it hurt, but it didn't stop anything. I mean, he did the same thing to check. But when he said it was time to break the water, then the head resident came in. And I will never forget, her name was Dr. Quinn, which I thought was amazing. She came in and checked me and looked at me. Actually, yeah, she looked at me and she said, I'll be right back. And then she grabbed the nurse and said, I need to talk to you immediately. And that was scary, obviously. They were gone for probably 5 to 10 minutes. And when they came back in, Dr. Quinn apologized to me and said, I'm not sure how the previous doctor missed this, but you're not even 1 centimeter dilated, so you should not have been given Pitocin yet. You should not have been, certainly shouldn't have been given the epidural yet. And now we're going to have to force your cervix open. And then we're going to have to hope that the baby gets moving faster than probably she wants to. So long story short, by the time that happened, I think I was 12 hours after him telling me that I was ready to get on Pitocin. I think I'd already been on Pitocin 12 hours by that point. And I ended up being in labor like 27 and a half hours. And it was horrible. I ended up with a high fever and my heart rate was going through the roof. I was not fully conscious for most of it. My daughter was in danger. And whenever she was finally delivered the next day, the doctor that had messed up, because he was banned from my room, by the way, after he made that error, the nurse was furious and she said, I promise he will not be back. But the next day he came back and he tried to apologize, sort of. He came in the room and said that he was sorry that there was a mistake, but I was in obvious pain. So he was just trying to check me quickly. And if I hadn't been in such discomfort or appeared to be in such discomfort, then he probably would have been able to check and wouldn't have been wrong. So essentially, it was my fault that my daughter and I almost lost our lives because of his error. That was my fault. And I didn't even know what to say. My husband told him that he had to leave and then he never came back. And I just wonder, you know, that was, I'm sure there were a handful of factors there, but certainly some of it had to do with the fact that even though I said that hurts, he did not amend the way that he was doing it. Even though I explicitly told him that this has never hurt me as much as you're hurting me. And he said, I'm sorry, that's just the way it is. So anyway, that would be my personal story. And I guess I will let you get back to Elizabeth and Beatrice.
Heather, thank you so much for your story. I want to get back to this idea that people don't believe women when they have pain, or that the medical field doesn't understand women's pain, and only once that they have, you know, men have experienced that pain, or that pain has a direct impact on men, do we actually care about it within the medical field or in the public sphere?
Yeah.
So the story itself is told by her husband, as though, like, we as a society can...
Which is also fascinating, right?
Absolutely. We can only believe that this sort of thing happens if a male voice confirms it.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that he describes her trauma.
Absolutely.
But he uses the words, the trauma of not being seen. Right.
And now she's not being heard, like, because he's telling her story.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it kills me. I mean, I get it. It's a trauma that she experienced, and she may not want to voice that trauma because it she may have absolutely, PTSD surrounding it.
Yeah.
But I think that that's really interesting, and it really speaks to, I think, a lot of women's experience that people don't believe their pain. They don't believe their experiences until it's confirmed by a third source, like a second source, somebody else, maybe another woman, maybe physically experiencing it themselves.
Yeah.
And this reminds me, there are these videos that went on that are on YouTube. You can search for them. Basically, they hook men up to a TENS unit, which is a electrode stimulation unit that they often use for pain reduction, but it can be pretty painful. They're also used with like sexual electrical play, but that's a whole nother story. But they hook them up to it to simulate the pain of childbirth. And childbirth is often used as like a punchline for how women experience pain and their reaction to it. But these men only really understood it once they had experienced it themselves. They weren't willing to believe their wives that it was really painful, that it was terrible, you know, all of these things. And this is this is really problematic because it stems from this kind of deeper social issue of women's voices and opinions not being enough. They have to be verified or repeated by a male colleague, a husband, a person of authority before they can be believed. And have you heard of this new term developed called heap-eating?
No, heap-eating. Oh, instead of like repeating, heap-eating, like mansplaining.
Yes. Oh, right. Like mansplaining. Okay. So it was coined by friends of an astronomer and professor, Nicole Gugliucci. I'm sure I pronounced that wrong, and I'm very sorry. Anyway, she's at Noisy Astronomer on Twitter. She tweeted the word's definition and how to use it. Her tweet garnered almost 200,000 likes and 65,000 retweets, which gives you a sense of kind of how often this happens. Anyway, she defines heap-eating as, quote, when a woman suggests an idea and it's ignored, but then a guy says the same thing and everyone loves it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very familiar to a lot of women. You share your ideas at work, but are met with silence. But then immediately afterward, some guy says the same thing and everybody loves it. In this case, you know, this woman comes in saying that she has pain. And then nobody believes her. Nobody, in this case, nobody believed her husband either. But he had to advocate. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He had to really, like, push it in order to get anybody to pay attention.
I think it also has a lot to do with men still being thought of as the more rational sex and women just being so emotional and so weak and so like sensitive and hysterical, right? I mean, I think an idea that comes up a lot in all of this is like the idea of the hysterical woman.
Absolutely. And honestly, I started taking my husband with me to some of my appointments with specialists so that they can't dismiss me when I say something. It's not just to have a witness and not just to have somebody else there who can like ask questions, but if it seems that they aren't taking me seriously, he can jump in and advocate for me. And that's bullshit. I mean, it's total bullshit it's that bullshit. I have to do that or that I feel like that's necessary. But, you know, if it gets me better medical care, I'm fine.
Then you do it.
Yeah,
it makes sense. It's horrible, but it makes sense. Yeah. So
take a pause for a second, ladies. Think about how awful this is. Or men who are listening to us, understand that this is really frustrating for us.
Yeah. It's like when a random guy hits on you and you have to pretend you have a boyfriend so he doesn't.
Yes.
It's also shit, but you sometimes have to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, there is a very interesting study by, and okay, I'm also going to pronounce that completely wrong, Anita Tarzian and Diane Hoffman.
Lovely.
And thank you. And it's actually called The Girl Who Cried Pain, A Bias Against Women in the Treatment of Pain. And it was published in, it's a study done on the University of Maryland in the School of Law. And so it's University of Maryland. And they found out that women are more likely than men to be undertreated or inappropriately diagnosed and treated for the pain. So, and they also found out, as I already said, that men are more likely to get pain medication for actual pain and women are more likely to get sedatives. And there are various theories on why that is the case. And they state that the idea behind that is that women complain more than men. Women are not accurate reporters of their pain. Men are more stoic, so that when they do complain of pain, then people assume that it's real, and women are better able to tolerate pain. That's also an idea behind it, or to have better coping skills than men. So very often female pain is perceived as exaggerated or constructed, which also leads to the problem that females are often treated much less aggressively until they prove that they are as sick as male patients. And one very typical example for that is the so-called Yentl syndrome. So the Yentl syndrome is the different course of action that heart attacks usually follow for women than men. And there is a problem with that because much of the medical research that was done on heart attacks focused on men because they were assumed to be kind of the prototypical human, right? And that, yeah, and later researchers found out that symptoms of heart attacks are very different can be very different in women, so atypical when you take the male as a norm. And the problem is that women are very often misdiagnosed because the symptoms present differently.
What's really interesting about that, and I'll talk about this a little bit more later, but the FDA in the United States, because of their concerns about women's hormones really screwing up testing of drugs and the fact that they didn't want drugs to affect women who might be or might get pregnant, they stopped doing medical tests, you know, testing drugs on women, and didn't start testing drugs on women again until the mid-90s to see whether how those drugs affected women. So most of the drug side effects that we had for most medication in the United States, or, and you know, because the United States does a lot of this drug testing worldwide, they were only for men and they had no idea how they affected women.
Yeah. All right. I mean, this is not going to be a fun episode. So, I mean, it started, it's going to get worse, I think, even.
Do you know about man flu?
I can imagine what it means, like the weird phenomenon that men die when they have the flu.
No, women don't. It's even better than that. It's kind of, I don't want to be too like rude toward men because I have a husband, he gets sick, like he legitimately gets sick. He powers through it when he gets sick because he has to work. But there are a lot of men who, as soon as they kind of get like the sniffles, they're incapable of doing anything, and they're like, oh God, I'm so sick.
Oh, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
That's what I meant when I said they die and women don't.
Oh, I thought you meant.
I was not taking that. That was not literally. No. They quote unquote die.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is a thing, at least a cultural phenomenon that people are aware of and that memes and YouTube videos have been made about. Obviously, it's making fun of kind of extreme cases of this.
Yes, of course.
But it's the same thing. You know, you treat a guy because if he is at the end of the world and literally, figuratively thinks that he's dying because he has a case of the sniffles, you know, you take that more seriously than a woman who has been like taking care of her kids all day and going to work and doing, taking care of the house and doing all these other things. Cause clearly she's not that sick.
Yeah, of course not. Yeah. And I actually have another quote from the study by Hoffman and Tarzian about the Yentl syndrome that I talked about earlier. So, quote, a recent prospective study of patients with chest pain found that women were less likely than men to be admitted to the hospital. Of those hospitalized, women were just as likely to receive a stress test as men, but those not hospitalized were less likely to have received a stress test at a one-month follow-up appointment, which is also a problem. So the authors attributed the differences in treatment to the Yentl syndrome. Women are more likely to be treated less aggressively in their initial encounters with the healthcare system until they prove that they are sick as male patients. Once they are perceived to be as ill as similarly situated males, they are likely to be treated similarly. The Yentl syndrome hypothesis fits well with the results of a study by Weir and colleagues, which found that of chronic pain patients who were referred to a specialty pain clinic, men were more likely to have been referred by a general practitioner and women by a specialist. So they already have like a longer way until they get to the clinic, right? So they have to prove that they're actually ill. The results should suggest that women experience disbelief or other obstacles at their initial encounters with healthcare providers. The interesting thing about that, however, because it's assumed that women just exaggerate the pain or are not to be taken seriously, but the fact of the matter is that very often women in reality understate the pain because of politeness or of not, you know, because of the fear of being classified as too emotional. right? And they kind of don't want to raise false alarm. There's a lot of anxiety around that for many women. So actually, they don't want to be melodramatic. So they not exaggerate the pain, but they kind of understate the pain. That's the actual problem.
Sure. And yeah, if I remember correctly, there are a lot of studies that show that most women have a higher pain threshold. So yes, in addition to having a higher pain threshold, they're minimizing the pain that they're in. So by the time they are actually reporting pain, it's significantly more serious than most men. And yet then they have to try and prove the pain is yeah, as bad as a man's, even though they've been, you know, maybe putting off going to the doctor or, you know, choosing mm-hmm, not to deal with the pain because they had other things to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had some pretty significant back pain. I had herniated a disc and I had several kind of bulging discs. And it wasn't yeah, until I physically couldn't get up off the ground.
That you were taking seriously.
That I finally decided to go to the doctor about
it. Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, that
because you didn't want to be, yeah.
I had too much other stuff to do. It wasn't until I started to experience, like, weakness in my leg, and I was having trouble getting, like, laying on the ground was one of the only comfortable positions, but then I literally mm-hmm, could not get up off the ground because I was in too much pain, and I was on the floor kind of crying, and I was like, I finally need to go to the doctor about this, and someone needs to take this seriously.
Yeah. And one of the reasons that women don't want to go to the doctors or sometimes or understand the pain is that they don't want to be classified as emotional, hysterical, melodramatic.
Yeah.
But then what happens, in fact, is that women often don't receive the treatment that they need because they're diagnosed wrong, or it's thought that they are emotional, that the problems that they have are psychogenic and therefore, quote unquote, not real, that it's kind of something psychosomatic going on. And what happens a lot is that women, instead of receiving appropriate care for their physical pain or physical problems, they sometimes receive treatment for mental health issues that might not even exist in reality. So, as I said, instead of pain medication, they get sedatives and stuff like that.
That happened to me in Germany when I was a teenager, actually.
Yeah.
I had gotten in a motorcycle accident and I had broken my foot. And you could see there was like a purple bump on the side of the foot. It was definitely broken. There was definitely something wrong. And mm-hmm, at this point, I had had maybe 2 years of high school German. So my German wasn't great, but it was mm-hmm, fine. I could describe what was wrong with me. And mm-hmm, the doctor kind of pressed on this purple bulge on the side of my foot and asked me if it hurt. And I screamed and said, yes, it hurt. And he said, he didn't believe me. He said, no, it can't hurt that bad.
Then
I stopped speaking to him in German because I wasn't going to talk to him anymore. And they gave me a sedative.
Nice. Okay, nice.
I was like 14 and they gave me a sedative. A 14-year-old girl, they gave a sedative because they didn't want to hear her screaming anymore because she was in pain.
Oh, yeah. That's nice.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, I actually, a few months ago, I had the experience of breaking my tibial plateau when I was abroad. And I went to the emergency room the next day because it was in very serious pain because I had like a swollen knee. I didn't know what was wrong. It was really, really painful. I'm not very sensitive to pain, but I, you know, it was really bad and really swollen. And they didn't diagnose it correctly. And also they were like, yeah, it's not that bad. Maybe like there's something wrong with the, what's the word, sena? Like
the meniscus?
Something. Maybe there's just, but it's nothing's broken. Nothing's like torn or something. So it's just a minor thing. You know, and I was like, I'm in serious pain. I don't think it's a minor thing. But they were like, oh, just get these crutches. Just be a little careful with it. And 3.5 weeks later, it finally got diagnosed, but only because of an MRT that I got that I paid for privately because they didn't do it themselves. So, you know.
Yeah, sure. MRIs are really expensive, but they're oftentimes the only way that you can actually get diagnosed.
Exactly. Yeah, right. And they wouldn't do that because they were like, there's nothing wrong. We didn't think there's anything wrong. And so I went around with a broken knee basically 3.5 weeks and was in a lot of pain. And then the MRI doctor was so shocked. Yeah, it's awful. It is awful. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if it has to do with me being a young woman coming to the emergency room, but maybe it does. I don't know.
Yeah, and I understand that there's a big concern in the medical community right now with people who are drug seeking, people who, particularly when they are addicted to painkillers, they're addicted to oxycodone, fentanyl, all of those kinds of things. And so if you're in pain, they want you to really prove that you're actually in pain because they're going to give you these painkillers, and they don't want you to just be drug seeking and looking for painkillers. But at the same time, you had pretty significant bruising on your knee. It was really swollen.
It was very swollen. It was like a tennis ball size of like a lump, basically, on my knee.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. And to be kind of just shrugged off, and because you fell on the bus, right?
Yeah, I fell down from like a double-decker bus from the like first floor to the ground, basically, when it stopped.
Sure. And they just think, oh, you just fell. Like, who has significant damage on their knee? Who breaks their knee? Who breaks a bone when they fall on the bus? Well, plenty of people.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, they did give me painkillers because you said that's a problem sometimes. They did give me painkillers. But what I actually thought would have been a good idea is a plaster, maybe, like a plaster cast. I would have needed. That's what I would have needed, not painkillers, you know. Yeah, so I took painkillers for a month because without them I couldn't have walked or even got up from bed, you know. So I just took painkillers and went on with my life, and I traveled to Berlin and a lift on the fourth floor, and I had to walk up and down because there was no elevator in that building. So, yeah, I just basically just soldiered through it. Sure. But I shouldn't have.
No, I mean, if you'd been properly diagnosed, if they'd cared to actually treat it and do the proper kind of testing for it, but you were a problem and they solved it by giving you drugs.
They just gave me, and told me to calm down, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the thing is, and that actually, the issue of women then sometimes being given, you know, sedatives, antidepressants for a problem that is actually physical is also an issue on another level, and that is that you already suggested that, Liz, that drugs very often affect female bodies different than they affect male bodies. So women have hormonal cycles. That's a big point, right? Women have smaller organs. Women have a higher body fat composition. Of course, like in general, that's not like not every woman has a higher body fat composition than every man, but it's just like a general rule. And all of those factors actually play a role in how drugs affect our bodies. We also have some basic differences in gene expressions, which affects drug metabolization. And one very, you know, well-known example is that men metabolize caffeine more quickly. Women metabolize certain antibiotics and anxiety medications more quickly. So yeah, there's just differences.
One really great example of that is there's a drug that they use as like a sleep aid, and I can't remember what it's called, but it starts with an A. Women hadn't been tested on women at all, but women metabolize it much more slowly, and so. Mm-hmm. They were waking up with their alarm, but the effects of the drugs had not worn off. So women were just kind of, they were getting in car accidents. They were having kind of significant, they were basically sleepwalking, but fully awake this sleep aid drug was still in their system significantly longer than it had been in men's system because it had never been tested on women and they didn't know how quickly it metabolized in women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, there's different levels of effectiveness in men and women, and there are also different side effects sometimes. And there's, you know, one thing that is very typical is that anesthesia and ibuprofen, for instance, can have very different effects in men and women. And there are even cases where women are much more at risk for adverse and even lethal side effects. And the reason for that is that for a long time, drugs were just generally tested on men because, as I said, they were just thought of as the human prototype and women are just like kind of men, you know, like a deviation a bit, but, you know, generally bit like, like incomplete men.
We screw up the studies, so they don't want like deviations to the norm.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then there's also an article in the New York Times called Gender Gap in Pain. And it's also written by an author that also experienced being dismissed herself. And she writes, "I am a sufferer of pain and chronic disease. Like many, I've had physical symptoms. In my case, respiratory problems and infections explained away as emotional. My freshman year in college, I was in the emergency room, flanked by machines and struggling to breathe while doctors lobbed questions at me. Why wasn't I responding to the medication the way they expected I would? Was I just too anxious? Could I not handle stress? And was that making me sick? I was 23 before I was given a correct diagnosis of a rare genetic lung disease called primary ciliary dyskinesia. I don't know. I'd been sick since birth, But long diagnostic journeys are occupational hazards of living with the conditions doctors don't often see. Still, my journey was unnecessarily protracted by my doctor's dismissal of my symptoms as those of a neurotic young woman.
And you see that with a lot of autoimmune diseases, which you can't actually, they're not diseases that you can see easily, so mm-hmm. it's really difficult to diagnose. But your body is basically attacking itself, mm-hmm. and they have no idea what it is. Fibromyalgia is one of those where you experience extreme joint and physical pain, but they can't prove that there's anything wrong with you. And there are a lot of women who suffer from fibromyalgia and other types of autoimmune diseases that they just get labeled as crazy. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. You know, you're just anxious. There's all these other things that are causing your symptoms. Do some mindfulness breathing. And yes, for people who are anxious, mindfulness is really helpful. But if it's an actual physical problem, mm-hmm. mindfulness is not going to do shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, one more note on the heart attack issue. So there is an interesting article on psmag.com called Is Medicine's Gender Bias Killing Young Women? And they also found out that, you know, heart attacks, in the case of heart attacks, women very often display very different symptoms. They're not recognized as heart attacks, and they don't get the right treatment, and they don't get it fast enough, and it very often is a lethal problem. And they also quote a series of studies led by psychologist Gabrielle Chiaramonti. Oh God, I'm sorry, Gabrielle. In 2008. And she kind of tried to provide some clues as to why that is. And in the first study, 230 family doctors and internists were asked to evaluate two hypothetical patients. So there's a 47-year-old man and a 56-year-old woman, and they have identical risk factors and the textbook symptoms of a heart attack. So that's chest pain, shortness of breath, irregular heartbeat. That's textbook heart attack, right? And half of the vignettes included a note that the patient had recently experienced a stressful life event and appeared to be anxious. And in the vignettes without that single line, there was no difference between the doctor's recommendations to the man and the woman. And despite the popular conception of the quintessential heart attack, patients as male, right, they seem to be capable of making the right call in the female patient too, which is interesting. But then, when stress was added as a symptom, there was an enormous gender gap all of a sudden. So only 15% of the doctors diagnosed heart disease in the woman, 15%, compared to 56% in the men, and only 30% referred the woman to a cardiologist, compared to 62% of the men. Okay, so that's shocking. And finally, only 13% suggested cardiac medication for the women, compared to 47% for the men. So the presence of stress kind of sparked a quote-unquote meaning shift in which women's physical symptoms were reinterpreted as psychological, while men's symptoms were perceived as organic, whether or not stresses were present.
Well, you know, because men are so much better at handling stress. So, of course, like, stress doesn't affect them physically.
Of course not, because they're strong men.
There's air quotes around
yeah,
all
yeah,
of
yeah,
that.
Of course, of course. So, and that's just the case when the patient's did experience the classic heart attack symptoms. There was a next twist to the study because the researchers asked 142 family physicians to assess a male and a female patient again presenting with atypical symptoms, which could be nausea or back pain, right? And this muddied the picture further because the woman was less likely than the men to receive a heart disease diagnosis, but neither was likely to get one at all. And when stress was added to the mix, both men and women were even more likely to be diagnosed with a gastrointestinal problem instead. So given the fact that women more commonly have both atypical symptoms, and signs of anxiety, the end result is, yet again, that women are left underdiagnosed. All right?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. It's not until recently that we've gotten this the kind of different set of symptoms for women when they have a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And it's, everybody knows about the like pain in the arm and chest tightness and all of that. But there's actually other symptoms that are specific to women mm-hmm. When they have a heart attack. And some of that is this pain in like the neck and jaw instead of maybe in the arm and a nausea particularly.
Yeah.
That those are those are really just women's symptoms of a heart attack. They don't present in men. And again, it's only recently that we have focused on that at all.
Completely, yeah. And of course, heart attacks are a very high stake, you know, context. Of course, there are also other contexts in which same phenomena appear that women are not taking seriously, that it's thought to be a psychogenic problem rather than a physiological problem, etc., etc. The article that I talked about also uses the term of medical gaslighting, which I found really, really fitting.
It pisses me off.
Yeah. And it also talks about the ever-increasing numbers of women prescribed anti-anxiety meds and antidepressants. The fact that women make up the majority of the 100 million Americans suffering from very often undertreated chronic pain, which very often has sources that nobody knows. You know, nobody knows why the people experience pain, but they just do. And it's very often women who are affected by it. And we could also kind of argue that maybe because it's women affected by it disproportionately, it's not taken seriously enough to actually find out what's going on.
Sure.
You know, 75% of all people with autoimmune diseases are women. They are very often labeled as chronic complainers in the early stages of their illness because it's not really diagnosed. And then there are diseases like chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia.
Very nice. Fibromyalgia.
Fibromyalgia. Okay. That affects mostly women, and it's of unknown, quote-unquote, unknown etiology. And very often people doubt that it's real diseases, and it's just, you know, in their heads and all of that. So
for a long time, people thought fibromyalgia was just totally fake.
Yeah.
And because they couldn't see the nerves firing, they couldn't see how the pain was presenting itself, they were just like, eh, this is fake. You're just faking it.
This is fake.
You just want, you know.
It's like hysteria all over again.
Absolutely. Totally hysteria all over again.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow. Take a breath.
I wish I had chocolate here. I really do.
Yeah. I just have tea, which is not as satisfying at all.
Tea is not satisfying at all when it comes to this.
No. Oh, only if you put whiskey in it, but I don't have whiskey in it either, so.
Ooh, I have whiskey. That's an idea.
We'll take a quick break. Elizabeth gets her whiskey.
It's Sunday morning here, though.
Sunday evening here,
Some of the problem, which I mentioned before, is that women have not been included in medical trials, particularly when it comes to drugs. But generally, women were not often included in trials. So in the journal Pharmacy Practice, there was a great article from 2016 entitled Women's Involvement in Critical Trials, Historical Perspectives and Future Implications by Catherine Liu and Natalie DiPietro Mager. I'm sure I pronounced that wrong. That describes kind of the history of medical trials, clinical trials for drugs in the United States. So regulations and guidance documents published by the FDA concerning women's participation in industry-sponsored clinical trials have significantly changed in the last 50 years. In the 70s, we had this drug called thalidomide, which could go through the placenta and affect the children. And we ended up having a lot of kids with, for a short period of time, because there was a doctor in the, or a woman at the FDA in the 1970s who limited the use of the drug in the United States. In Europe, the drug was used as an anti-nausea medication, particularly for women who were pregnant. And it significantly affected a generation of kids, causing them to have like malformed limbs and other problems. But because of this, the guidance document stated that women of childbearing potential should be excluded from phase one and phase two research, except if these studies were being conducted to test a drug for a life-threatening illness. So
I find that, I'm sorry, but I find that term, women of childbearing potential. Yes.
So what that means is anybody who has already had their period and who has not gone to menopause.
Yeah.
So anybody from basically the age of 12-ish to 50-something, 60-something, were not to be included in phase one and phase two drug trials because they could potentially get pregnant.
Because what needs to be protected is not the woman.
No, it's the baby.
But her possibility.
Yes.
Her potential of bearing a child. That's what needs to be
protected. Not even pregnant women. Like, of course you're not necessarily going to test it on pregnant women, which is somewhat of a problem because we do need to know how these drugs affect pregnant women as well. But I get it. Like, you don't want to endanger, like, two lives.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if I'm not having children and I'm not pregnant and I'm not trying to get pregnant and I don't ever want little ever monsters running it. Around yeah. my house, include me in a freaking trial. I volunteer.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah.
So anyway, so if the drug later appeared to have kind of a favorable risk-benefit assessment, so like, okay, it could hurt children, but the benefits are better, then they might be included in later phases. But mm-hmm. yeah, this childbearing potential thing was a real problem. Because it was anyone who could become pregnant, including
yeah.
premenopausal single abstinent women.
Yeah, because you need to protect our precious reproductive organs.
Yes, yes. Women with sterile partners or lesbians who aren't actively in danger of having a child unless they're seeking out the possibility to have a child.
Women who just don't fucking want to have children like us.
Yes.
But we still have childbearing potential, Liz.
Yeah, we do.
We do have potential.
When the breeding camps come, when the Handmaid's Tale style breeding camps come, you know.
There's still hope for us. We do have potential.
Yeah, exactly. Good. So advocacy groups criticized the 1977 FDA guideline and argued that trial participation should be focused on a woman's independence to make decisions. And said that the guidance was rigid and paternalistic, leaving virtually no room for the exercise of judgment by responsible research subjects, physician investigators, and IRBs, like investigational review boards, but nobody gave a shit. So then they lifted the ban eventually, and then left it up to women themselves to decide whether they were going to participate. But for the most part, we didn't get women being included in drug studies actively until 1998. The FDA finally issued a rule entitled Presentation of Safety and Effectiveness Data for Certain Subgroups of the Population, namely women, mm-hmm. in investigational mm-hmm. new drug application reports and new drug applications. And I remember this because they had gotten a new head at the FDA when I was in DC. It was all over the local news because suddenly this woman who was leading the FDA was saying, you need to start testing this stuff on women.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What a radical idea.
Yeah. The FDA has an Office of Women's Health, mm-hmm. which was created in 1994 by congressional mandate, which has two overarching goals: to protect and advance the health of women through policy, science, and outreach, and to advocate for the participation of women in clinical trials for sex, gender, and subpopulation analyses. So that organization is there. You know, it started four years before this new guidance on including women in clinical mm-hmm. trials. And now women are included as a group. And as I said before, you know, because women were not included as a group for these drug trials, we have a lot of drugs that were passed in the 70s and 80s that we really don't necessarily know precisely how they affect women. Yeah. So many groups, including the FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institute of Health, clinicians, academia, Congress, industry, like the drug industry, and advocacy groups, have an interest in ensuring the appropriate enrollment of women in clinical trials and sex-specific analysis of the data, if only so that they don't get sued. Let's be honest. Mm-hmm. That's really the only thing that they care about, is not having someone sue them because the medicine kills their wife. Well, having a man sue them because the medicine kills their wife or
that's
whatever.
That's a pain.
Yeah. But it's critical that data from women are available when making decisions on dosing, safety, and efficacy of therapeutic agents in the United States, or worldwide, actually. There has been a shift in the U.S. in the philosophy in how to best protect the public's health. And instead of simply excluding women of childbearing potential, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. from participation in these kind of early phase research, it's now recognized that risk can be mitigated in these drugs in later stages by including women much earlier. And so they've sought to kind of establish guidelines for this. I mean, again, you don't want to necessarily have a woman who is pregnant, mm-hmm. actively pregnant, and who wants to keep the baby, testing a drug that they don't know how it's going to affect her or the baby. But maybe that's a risk that she's willing to take if she's got something else that is even more dangerous. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that's drugs in the United States.
Nice. Thank you, Liz. That was very uplifting. After my, you know,
part hopeful, right?
Yeah, after my part about pain, now we know that also drugs kill us because they're not, they haven't been tested on us for a long time. So yeah, nice.
But they're increasingly performing these tests, and a lot of the drugs, they, you know, if they have had adverse effects on women, they're actually going back and testing them on women.
That's a good
to make sure of what the efficacy is, what the side effects are, because they may be different.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's positive.
Yeah, it is positive.
Maybe.
Maybe.
So when you think of the biggest diagnosis of women throughout time, what do you think that is?
Hysteria!
Yes. So, I mean, I think we can all agree that women have been described as hysterical.
Yeah.
Probably more than most men.
Oh, really? Do you think so?
I'm just off a guess. The top of my head.
Yeah, it's just a feeling you have, right? You don't really know.
I think I have literally heard the phrase, don't be hysterical. Many times in my life, directed at me.
Yeah, yeah. And you think that has some connection with the fact that you're a woman? I mean,
I don't think I've ever heard a man describe as hysterical.
Yeah, it might be. I don't know if I can believe you, Liz, because you are very emotional.
I'm a woman.
You're very hysterical, so I don't know.
I get it.
You're so hysterical. I don't think I can take you very seriously when you say that you've been called hysterical. I don't know.
No, yeah. I don't think so. No. But there's an article in the Clinical Practice and Epidemiology of Mental Health entitled Women and Hysteria in the History of Mental Health, published in 2012, that really documents the history of this kind of exclusively female disease. So it was the first mental disorder attributed to women, accurately described in the second millennium BC, and until Freud, considered an exclusively female disease.
Nice.
We have a great recording from Heather on kind of some ancient discussions of hysteria that give us a really good kind of historical perspective on how far back this goes and how long this has been a problem.
And we're going to play that now.
So Elizabeth found a really interesting article, and part of the article discusses the history of hysteria. And since history is something that I am fascinated with, I wanted to take over this part of the discussion. So in the article, they discuss hysteria from ancient times, like I said. So there's a mention of something called the Kahun Papyrus, which was dated to 1900 BCE. It discusses how ancient Egyptians were concerned with and studied supposed hysteria in women. The papyrus gives us an insight on how hysteria was described for women. And it's interesting because hysteria was considered the result of spontaneous movement of the uterus within the body. The first medical document, 300 years later, that discussed the symptoms of hysteria attributed it to malpositioning of the uterus within the body. And this particular document gives a description of how to fix this problem depending on whether the uterus was malpositioned too high or too low. So if the uterus was too high, then foul-smelling substances would be placed near the woman's nose, while perfumes would be placed near the vagina. This supposedly would cause the uterus to lower back down into position, because I guess they felt that the uterus was attracted to pleasant smells, and of course opposed to malodorous smells. So likewise, if the uterus was too low, then bad-smelling substances would be placed near the vagina, and perfumes would be placed near the woman's nose in attempts to coax the uterus to move upward and back into its natural position. Ancient Greece was no less fascinated by the idea of hysteria in women, and how that was attributed to something with the uterus. All the big names of Greece that you can think of, like Plato, Aristotle, Hippocrates, who, by the way, was the first one to actually use the term hysteria. And even the playwright Euripides believed that hysteria and, quote, melancholy of the uterus, end quote, was due to women who were deprived of orgasm and needed the company of a strong, virile man to satiate their desire and eventually, of course, to bear children because, you know, without both of those things, women could not be cured. So it was up to the men to save the women and make the ultimate sacrifice of having sex with them so that the females in society could live a life with a content uterus. Hippocrates, for example, explained that women's bodies were cold and wet, and therefore they were grounds for putrefaction of the humors. This caused the sick uterus to wander around the body and attack other areas, of the woman's body. Some other symptoms that might have been present in a woman with hysteria could be paralysis, tremors, convulsions, anxiety, and a sense of suffocation. Due to the dangers present from a sick uterus, Hippocrates encouraged those who were able to marry as soon as possible and get back on the train of sexual activity and procreation if they could. Hysteria was a danger to virgins, widows, single women, and sterile women, which I think is interesting. In fact, I think it's kind of funny because later this turns into one of the ultimate negative examples of behavior, but in Euripides, there are examples of women being cured of this illness if they participated in the orgies that were so typical of the Dionysian mysteries. So all a woman had to do was behave like a Maenad, and her uterus would be happy. I say this as entertaining because just a few centuries later in Rome, the Maenads were demonized, imprisoned, and killed because of their supposed behavior, which made them easy scapegoats for a statewide witch hunt. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But speaking of ancient Rome, the physician Galen doesn't take much of a different stance than that of Hippocrates. He encouraged women supposedly suffering from hysteria to follow a regimen of certain herbs, as well as repressing stimuli that could excite them. And the ultimate savior of a bad uterus would be, of course, getting married, according to Galen. And then the physician Soranus, who is considered the founder of scientific gynecology and obstetrics, we're now talking about like the early to mid 2nd century CE, took a completely different route. He believed that such disorders came about due to the toll the childbirth placed on a woman's body. So he suggested, for recovery of hysteria, that a woman take a life of abstinence paired with massage, hot baths, and exercise.
So over 4,000 years of history, for 4,000 friggin' years, this disease was considered from two perspectives, the scientific and the demonological. So,
of course.
Possession.
Yep.
By demons.
Mm-hmm.
It was cured with herbs, sex, or sexual abstinence. Yes. You know, whichever.
Yep, both.
Get a vibrator.
Choose.
Vibrate the hell out of that hysteria.
Yeah. I do that all the time. It works.
Punished and purified with fire for its association with sorcery. Mm-hmm. And finally, it has been clinically studied as a disease and treated with innovative therapies.
Okay.
So, and even at the end of the 19th century, scientific innovation had still not reached some places where the only known therapies were those proposed by Galen, which I would assume is a medieval doctor. I'm going to put that in quotes. Sure. And during the 20th century, several studies suggested that the decline of hysteria among Occidental patients, so Western patients, both in women and men, and the escalating of this disorder in non-Western countries was happening. So somehow, like, as we became more advanced, hysteria decreased, but in the developing world, hysteria was on the rise. I'm not sure how that happens, but okay. The concept of hysterical neurosis was finally deleted from the diagnostic manual, the third one, in 1980.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Yeah.
And the evolution of these diseases seem to be a factor linked with kind of social westernization. So maybe we're not hysterical anymore. Maybe now we're depressed. We have bipolar. We have any number of other illnesses, whether physical or psychological, that have taken the place of hysteria.
So Liz, when you said deleted from the diagnosis manual in 1980, do you talk about the American DSM?
Because
there's also a European manual whose name I forgot, but there are different diagnosis manuals in America and Europe.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize and that. I assumed that we all agreed on these diagnoses.
No, there's a different one in Europe. I'm not sure. There are two different ones. And the fascinating thing is, of course, that the diagnoses are different. And that what counts as a mental illness and what doesn't is also different. And also those DSMs also change every year a bit. So our definition of what counts as a mental illness also changes.
Sure.
I think we should maybe do We should maybe do at one point an episode just about mental illness and what it means when it comes to gender, and also those definitions of what counts as
absolutely
mental illness.
So stay tuned for a future episode where we talk about kind of the differences in diagnoses, particularly gender diagnoses in mental illness.
Yeah.
So the article really looks at a couple of different kind of dominant approaches of looking at mental disorders, the magic demonological and the scientific in relation to women. So not only is a woman vulnerable to mental disorders, she is weak, easily influenced by the supernatural or by organic degeneration, apparently.
Yeah.
She's somehow guilty of sinning or not procreating. And thus kind of,
or both,
yes. And thus, so mental disorders, especially in women, are often misunderstood and misinterpreted, and it generates a scientific and or moral bias defined as kind of a pseudoscientific prejudice. Mm-hmm. In the 19th and 20th centuries, studies gradually demonstrate that hysteria is not an exclusively female disease, allowing a stricter scientific view to finally prevail. Though I would say maybe hysteria is like a bad diagnosis anyway.
Yes, because it encompasses everything.
Yeah, it's basically like maybe anxiety, maybe, you know, a lot of
maybe depression,
different things,
maybe psychosis, maybe it's just a too broad a term to be used as a diagnosis.
Yeah, so there's been a modification to hysteria from of diagnosing as hysteria to really diagnosing like mood disorders instead, as we have a better taxonomy and a better description of the emotional state that people are going through. We have a better vocabulary for describing possible mood disorders.
All right. We hope this episode wasn't too depressing. I hope you had enough chocolate to assist you in this.
Any final thoughts?
Get a vibrator for your hysteria, ladies.
And I think if we're going to have some lessons learned from this as women as patients is don't be afraid to be an advocate for yourself. Everybody has a man who can be there as an advocate for them, nor do they want a man who to be there as an advocate for them.
Yeah,
We need to learn how to express ourselves in a way that people are going to believe us until society comes around to a point where they just believe us because we're human beings expressing our symptoms and our pain.
Exactly. So be insist on getting the medical care you need. Be annoying as fuck if you have to.
Absolutely.
Be persistent.
Absolutely. Perfect.
And stay nasty.
Stay nasty.
Bye.